This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
I'm Katrina Perry from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at Twitch. The biggest live streaming platform in the world is struggling to turn a profit. And now reports suggest that parent company Amazon could be losing patience in the project that it purchased for almost $1 billion a decade ago. The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Jessica Crichton. Welcome to the Woman's Hour podcast. Good morning. Really good to be back with you here on Woman's Hour. Now, it might be 4 days since the Paris Olympics ended, but we're still very much feeling games fever here. And we'll be celebrating with one of the most popular members of Team GB after her medal in Paris. I'll give you a clue. She has one of the biggest smiles in sport and picks up some seriously heavy weights. Well, that was two clues, wasn't it? You might have seen her competing. And if so, you would have seen her celebration when her bronze medal was confirmed. It was a cartwheel. It was a great moment. One of my personal highlights. Maybe you've done something similar when you've had something to celebrate. When you've had some good news, I should say, or reached a special milestone. How have you chosen to mark the occasion? What's been your celebration? It might not be something as energetic as a cartwheel, of course. Maybe you did a little dance, punched the air. Maybe you made your favourite meal, had a glass of something nice. Let me know. Text in on 84844. Remember that texts will be charged at your standard message rate. You can WhatsApp me as well on 03700 100 444. On social media, we're at BBC Women's Hour. You can email us through our website as well. Now, some of you might know that I played a lot of football when I was younger and I was fortunate enough to score a few goals in my time. In my cup final, I remember once scoring a really late winning goal and immediately just overcome with emotion. I don't know where my mind went, but I went wild. I was running around, arms in the air, flailing everywhere, and eventually pulled my football shirt up over my head. Absolutely lost control. So basically running around, not being able to see where I was going, showing far too much flesh. But I don't know what happened. In that moment, you're just celebrating. And that's what I chose to do in that moment. But let me know your celebration moments. Get in touch, text, WhatsApp, social media, and email. Now, I'll also be joined this morning by the actor Cara Wilson to discuss her play at the Edinburgh Fringe, which celebrates the work of artist Beryl Cook. And I'll speak about keeping it in the family, because I'll be talking to her daughter, the comedian Nina Conti, as well. She'll be joining us. She's also working at The Fringe, making her debut as a film director. We'll also have an exclusive interview with a woman who received damages from the Crown Prosecution Service after they admitted to wrongly dropping her legal case when she was allegedly raped. All of that to come. But first, I did promise you a very special guest. That's because earlier this week, Nuala asked who your favourite female Olympian was at the Paris Games. Now, lots of you told us how much you enjoyed watching trampoline athlete Bryony Page and the BMX rider Bethany Schriever. But there was one woman who you loved watching even more. And that was, of course, Team GB weightlifter Emily Campbell. Not only were you impressed by her incredible strength, but also her infectious personality and, of course, her colourful hair. Emily won a bronze medal at the Games, adding to the silver that she won at the last Olympics. She lifted a total of, get this, 288 kilograms, a personal best for her, made up of 126 kilograms in the snatch event and 162 kilograms in the clean and jerk. Emily, that is absolutely incredible. Welcome to Woman's Hour.
Thank you so much for having me. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. And it's so good to be sitting across from you. That trademark smile. You look great. You sound great. Can we just get to that weight? Because 288 kilograms. So I looked this up. It's like the size of maybe a baby grand piano.
Wow.
Or a couple of those US-style American fridge freezers.
Oh, yeah, the super big fridge freezers.
Lifted above your head.
Oh, it's pretty cool when you say it like that, isn't
pretty
it?
Pretty cool, she says. So matter-of-factly. That is an incredible weight.
Yeah, no, definitely. And this, it's really funny because it's like everyday life to me that they just go to the gym and lift heavy stuff. And then when people like compare it to things like that, you're like, oh, yeah, it's kind of heavy.
Wow. Can we talk about the cartwheel? The celebration?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not convinced that Simone Biles would see that and be quivering and thinking I've got some competition, but it was still a great cartwheel.
No, definitely. I think the term for it is there's room for improvement. But no, it's we have a good time in training. We like, you know, it's very intense a lot of the time and we try and have a lot of fun. And I was messing about one day in training and my coach was like, that has got to be the worst cartwheel I've ever seen in my life. And he was like, you need to do that as a celebration one day. And he asked me to do it after the Commonwealth Games and I totally forgot. I got like a bit like you, I was like engrossed in the moment, just enjoying it, and you forget everything and all the plans go out the window. But then this time I just remembered and I was like, I think it's time to do the cartwheel. So I did it. So now he's happy and I got a really cool photo as well. But yeah, British Gymnastics, wherever you are, you know, I'm ready for LA.
4 years of training, you don't need it.
That's it. Maybe I will be, you know, giving Simone Biles a run for money.
Tell me about this bronze medal. How proud are you? It was a really stacked field, a really tough medal to just for you to get on the podium with such incredible athletes, a Chinese athlete as well who won gold, South Korean athlete that won silver. How do you feel now that you've had a few days to reflect on this all?
Yeah, it's been really overwhelming, to be fair, because it's been a difficult road to these games. Like, it wasn't very straightforward for me. Like, I had a coach change, I had lots of injuries, I had loads of things, and you know, you do get to a point sometimes where you sit there and think, am I going to even be able to get on the start line, never mind be able to contest for a medal?
Really? Was that up in the air, was it?
Yeah, it was, you know, it was pretty difficult for me. Like, 2023, I had to pull out of the World Championships, I didn't really have any international performances at all, and then in 2024 I managed to retain my European title, but it wasn't a performance that I was proud of. You know, it was great and, you know, I was very, very thankful to be able to have another European title, but at the same time I was like, this performance is not going to do me anything at the Olympics. Like, I really have to, you know, pull it out of the bag. So yeah, it was to even be there, I was, you know, as ecstatic, but then obviously me being the very competitive person that I am, I was like, you know, you've come this far, we've got to finish the job now. So to finally get, you know, another medal, and obviously, you know, people keep saying to me, oh my god, you're a double Olympic medalist, and like to say that out loud in words is pretty surreal.
How,
you know,
does it
what
feel?
I mean, yeah, it's incredible. Like, honestly, it is, because you know, you see every single athlete that gets on that stage, gets on that track, gets on wherever they're doing, they've all trained so hard to be there, and not everybody gets rewarded with the amount of work that they've put in, you know. And we get back and, you know, everyone's focused on medals and stuff and whatever, but actually, you know, it's been a journey for absolutely everyone to get there. So obviously to be rewarded for your hard work and be able to bring back another medal, and especially to shine another spotlight on British weightlifting as well, you know, we're all working really, really hard. I was the sole representation of,
yes,
great British weightlifters,
yes,
at the games as well, so it was solely on my shoulders to, you know, bring back something positive for our sport, and I'm just so glad that I was able to do it
and do it extremely, extremely well. Now, I mentioned the weight that you lifted. Is it true that you don't know what weight you're going to lift when you get onto that platform to perform the actual lift?
Yeah, a lot of the time I haven't got a clue. Yeah, I can't.
So your coaches decide for you?
Yeah, so you have a bit of a ballpark because you've warmed up in the back, so you kind of know what weights you do in the back and you kind of know where you are. But yeah, they know exactly what everybody else has lifted. They know what you need, obviously, to place you, etc. So they make all the decisions. So yeah, I didn't have a clue at all. And even that last lift, like, I knew it was pretty heavy. I knew I needed it for
silver.
So you
didn't know it was for a medal?
So I didn't know the first one was for a medal at all.
Wow.
I just knew that the first one is, like, your first lift is so important because that sets the pace for the rest of the competition. So I knew, you know, you need to get this first clean and jerk in because then you've got a total on the board and then you've got room to move. You miss this and then you're playing catch up. And obviously I knew the girls were so close and it wasn't going to make it easy for me. So in my head, I was just like, I just need to nail this. And then it was kind of like, I only knew that then I secured a medal on the final lift because my coach said to me, you nail this, we get silver. And I was like, oh, I've already got a medal. And then I tried to like wipe that out of my brain, because I was like, right, no, wipe that out of your brain. Like, you need to concentrate on this. So yeah, but I, you know, I trust them guys with all my life, because, you know, they've coached me my whole career. They know exactly what they're doing. They work really, really hard. I've put them in some really sticky situations before in championships, and they've always managed to come out good and pull for me. So, you know, I just have to have that faith that they have in me and just go out there and execute the lift.
Yeah, absolutely incredible. I find it absolutely remarkable that you're not exactly sure of what you're lifting. It's incredible. Tell us about the different types of lift though, because you've got the snatch,
yep,
and then you've got the clean and jerk, and it's the total of those two lifts that make your total, which determines the medal.
Correct. Yeah, so you always snatch first, and that tends to be the lighter lift of the two that you do. So snatch is the wide grip that you take straight from the floor and put straight above your head and stand up. So that one is the hardest, and there is just no room for error. And I'm not a massive fan of snatch, but actually this championships I snatched the best I've ever snatched in my whole career. Wow. Yeah, my, we call the snatchers were snatching, that's what we were saying, because literally I knew that if I got a good snatch in, I would have a very good chance of getting a medal in, because clean and jerk is a stronger one for me, so I'd be able to make up. And then you go on to the clean and jerk, so there's always a 10-minute break in between, you reset, and then the clean is where you clean it onto the chest, stand up, and then jerk above the head. So there's three different styles of jerks that you can do. You can do a squat jerk, which means you bend your legs and go back down with the weight above your head. You can do a power jerk, which is just splitting the feet either side, and then you do the split jerk, which is what you saw me do, which is where you split the feet back and forward. So yeah, not many people do the squat jerk. That's a very Chinese move. You have to be extremely strong to do that, but you know, there's the choice there to do whichever one you prefer.
Wow, it's very technical. It's not just lifting heavy things up. There's an art form, isn't there? There's, yes, an art form to it. So tell us how you got into this, because I think it happened by accident. You were actually competing in shot and hammer, is that
correct?
Right, and randomly one day, after a suggestion from a coach, started weightlifting.
Yeah, they just basically suggested that if I did the weightlifting movements, it would make me stronger for the shot, and I would throw the shot further. So I was like, what's the worst that can happen? I'll give it a go. Started with a coach up at my old university in Leeds, and yeah, just kind of fell in love with the sport. And then he kind of convinced me, was like, I know you didn't want to compete, but you know, you just get a membership and get a suit and you can do a comp. If you hate it, you never have to do it again. And I just absolutely fell in love with it. Like, I loved the complexity of it. Like, I love one day that you went in and it was going really well and you felt like you was making progress, and then the next day you looked like you'd never done it in your life, and it used to frustrate me. I used to want to go, yeah, so humbling. Like, you know, I was a decent level at a shot put. I used to go to qualify for national championships. I went to small nation internationals, and I thought, you know, this can't be that hard. No, weightlifting humbled the hell out of me. And I really had to like go back to basics and, you know, really work on my technique. And, you know, you can be as strong as you want, but if the technique's not right, it will really, you know, disadvantage you. So yeah, I just loved the journey of trying to get better. And before you know it, you're stuck in like the hole of keep going back and getting better and better and better. And then yeah, I qualified for Commonwealth Games within 18 months of starting weightlifting.
Wow.
And I won bronze in Gold Coast in 2018, and then that's kind of what sparked me to be like, okay, I'm going to take this seriously now and I'm going to really give it a good shot. And yeah, and the rest is history.
Wow, it sounds like you've become obsessed with it, addicted to it, and a lot of elite athletes have to do that, I suppose, to get to the very top. Now, I mentioned earlier about our listeners really just feeling that they could relate to you. They love the fact that you were so vocal about positive body image. And I know that's been something that you've spoken out a lot about. Why is it that you want to focus on what your body can do rather than what your body looks like?
Because I just think this Olympics has definitely proved how different we all are and how amazing things that we all do as women. I mean, and men as well, you know, we're not forgetting about men, but women in particular, we are incredible creatures. No matter what we look like or what, no matter how we are, the things that we can achieve and things that we can do. And I think that those are things that can be celebrated. I feel like in the past and still now sometimes, you know, it's always focused on how we look or how we dress or what we do. And actually it's not about the things that we achieve and the things that you know, the impacts we have on people. And, you know, there's women in this world that have such incredible impacts on the world. And sometimes it's always overshadowed by how they look. And I just don't think that men get the same criticism as what women do. You know, for example, I'm in the super heavyweight class, so it means that I can wear anything over, so for the Olympics it was 81 kilos and normally it's 87 kilos, so anything above that you fit into that class. So you could be, you know, 100 kilos, you could be 150 kilos. And we get a lot of criticism about the fact that we're unhealthy and we don't look great. But then the men, they have a super heavyweight class and they're exactly the same as us, but they're champion for being strong and powerful and inspiring. And if we was going to compare, they were exactly the same as us. And I just find that really frustrating, and it just disencourages women from being able to do what they want to do. And I feel like we're in an era now where women are starting to prove that we really can do whatever we want to do. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we do it a lot better. So, you know, I just think that, you know, there was times where I realised that, you know, oh, people are quite interested in what I'm saying. So, you know what, I'm going to try and say the things that I feel like matters. And just personal experience as well, like with gym kit and, you know, being in spaces and, you know, I still as a woman can't walk into a shop now really and buy clothes. You know, why I not? Have to order online because the sizes aren't big enough for me. So it's like when you have those experiences yourself and you experience, you think, well, how many more people are going through this? And the more I spoke to people and the more I spoke out about people, the more people I had coming to me, well, I have this problem and I really wanted to start going to the gym, but, you know, all the gym outfits are really horrible and I can't find anything to fit me. And I'm like, we're trying to encourage people to be healthier and to be more active and to be out there, but we can't even get a great gym kit to fit us to start off with. So how do you expect, if you want people to be healthier and lose weight, how do you even start if you can't put a nice outfit on to even go and do that? So I realised that it was actually a bigger problem than I thought it was. And then I thought, well, if I've got a platform to be able to speak about it, then I'm going to speak about it.
And you mentioned your weight there, and I know you've spoken about this publicly before, but when you started weightlifting, you were a certain weight, mm-hmm. and you've had to increase your weight, haven't you, over the last Correct. 8-9 years to be able to perform on the level that you want to perform at. Has that been a difficult process, or was it for you, I'm just going to do what I need to do to be at the elite level?
Yeah, I think in the beginning it was a difficult, because I feel there was like all these pressures to be like, you know, oh, you know, is that healthy? Should you be doing that? Should you be doing that?
And just then so actually, people are aware, it's like a 20 to 30 kilogram weight increase.
Yeah, I was around 98 kilos when I first started weightlifting, and I sit now around 130 to 135 kilos. So yeah, it's been a massive increase. You know, that's 2-3 clothes size difference. Do you know what I mean? So it has been very different. But then when I realised what my body was able to do, when I put the weight on, when I started actually putting the weight on, for me was healthier. Like I was actually eating properly, I was fueling myself properly, I was sleeping properly, I was coming into the gym, and then all of a sudden weights that I was struggling with are a lot easier to lift, and then I'm putting more on, and then I'm thinking, hold on a minute, I've gone from someone who's dreaming about being on a world stage to actually being be able to compete on a world stage. And then for me, it was a no-brainer. Mm. It was like, you know, this is what I need to do to perform my sport effectively, and that's what I have to do. And, you know, I eat very well. Like, I eat very good meals. Like, you know, you don't just, you know, it took me a very long period. It took me maybe 5 or 6 years to be able to put this weight on. It didn't just happen like overnight, but it is. It's about like, you know, I work with a nutritionist and she's absolutely fantastic, Sinead. And, you know, she sets me a plan, and, you know, it's about my love for cooking has come back as well, because being able to like get creative with foods and all these different things. So actually it's been a really positive thing. And like I said, you know, I always say this as a woman, your body's going to change throughout your life, right? Age, whatever. And it's about learning to love every single part of you in different stages of your life, because it's never, ever going to be the same.
Now, as much as you stress the importance of the functionality of your body, your aesthetic is always, Emily, it's fabulous, isn't it? Slick makeup when you're on that platform about to lift, your trademark hair in buns, intricately designed for this last Olympics with the Olympic rings weaved into the back of your head. It was absolutely fantastic. Why is it so important that you look a certain way when you're lifting?
I just think I'm always in that aesthetic of look good, lift good.
Okay.
And you will find that a lot with a lot of the weightlifting females. We're lucky. We don't have any water splashing at us. We don't have to wear a helmet. We don't have any of those things. So actually we can have really nice hair and really nice makeup. And there's nothing more empowering than seeing a beautiful girl with loads of weight above her head, you know. And you'll see a lot of the South American girls, they wear amazing head wraps that match their suits, and they'll do nice eye makeup as well. And I think it's kind of evolved throughout the years, like more and more girls in weightlifting have gone, you know what, I can still be my feminine self and still lift amazing weights. So I think it's been really encouraging for all of us to like see that we're starting this movement. And you know, obviously the track and field girls, they are like absolute glamour, aren't they? You know, our girls are beautiful and they always look beautiful on the track. And I think that, you know, we're trying to kind of do, we're inspired by them and kind of do the same thing. And I just, yeah, I just think it's really important to just be who you are. Like, if you don't want to wear makeup and you just want to slick your hair back and you just want to put it in a bun and you want to get on with business, admire that too, you know what I mean? But then if you want to wear a full face of makeup and you want to put your lip gloss on and you want to do that, then do that as well. And I just think it's about, you know, showing women that we have choices. Like, you can do what makes you feel confident and what makes you feel empowered, and it doesn't matter what other people think.
Now, you haven't spent all that long in the sport, but already achieved some fantastic things, European titles, a Commonwealth Games title, world medals, a double Olympic medalist. You're going on holiday now. Are you going to have some rest? What's next?
Yes, no, I absolutely am. Yeah, I'm going away with my friend next week. We're going to have a few days away in Jamaica, so I'm really looking forward to that.
Which is a country of your heritage.
Absolutely, yeah. So it'll be nice to go back to the land and enjoy and celebrate with some good food. I'm very much looking forward to the food, and enjoy myself. And then, yeah, get back, kind of have a discussion with the team, regroup, and we'll see what's next.
LA? 2028? Am I getting ahead of myself?
I will never say never.
Okay. We've had a message in, we've had loads of messages in, but one message in particular I want to read out from someone who's listening called Michelle. She says, I live in Nottingham. We are rightly so proud to claim Emily Campbell as one of ours. I tell her there's always the kettle on at my house for her.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm very proud to be from Nottingham. I'm very proud of the people in Nottingham, and I'm very, very proud to keep representing us.
And you've been representing so, so well. Congratulations on your bronze medal and the silver from the last Olympics. Emily Campbell, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for coming on to Woman's Hour.
Thank you, Jess. Thank you.
Now, it's A-level results day in England, Wales and Northern Ireland. But over in Scotland, results day has already been and gone, and schools across the country are set to go back this week. In Glasgow, a parents group has begun legal action over the City Council's plan to cut 450 teachers over the next 3 years. The Glasgow City Parents Group is calling on the council to halt the implementation of those cuts. Leanne Maguire is the group's chair and she joins me now. Good morning, Leanne.
Good morning, Jo.
Just tell us what your concerns are then.
Yeah, so, I mean, 450, it's a big number and we're definitely going to feel it in Glasgow. So a good example of that is in this first year, we're going to lose 100, well, we've lost 172 teaching posts, and that will mean 45 of our primary schools will only have the head teacher out of class. So there will be no one else to cover any sickness if there's multiple incidents within the school. And that's just one example of how these drastic cuts are going to impact our schools.
So what have the teachers, or I should say the parents, what have the parents been telling you? I know you've been speaking to a few.
Yeah, so we've been getting messages in for months now. Obviously, we've been campaigning around this for about 6 months. And the stories that we're getting from parent councils are concerns that they're not going to have small group work in the school. So if there are some kids that need additional support, they're maybe pulled out into a nurture group. That won't be able to happen. School trips may not be able to happen because there won't be no staff to support that. So it's all this kind of additionality that schools put on top of everyday teaching. The staff are now just stripped right down to the bone. So that's just not going to be feasible.
And then the impact on the teachers will be?
They possibly burn out. I mean, we've been working in partnership with all of the teaching unions in Scotland, so we're all on the same page around this. They are actually moving to ballot on strike action. So in Scotland, our kids are going to go into another year of school disruption. We have already experienced that for the past 4 years with strikes and pandemics, but I want to make it clear as a group, we don't blame unions for moving to strike action this time round. It's totally understandable. And as far as we are concerned, the blame lands at the council or Scottish Government for not intervening.
And you mentioned that some of the children will obviously feel the consequences of this decision. But in particular, children with additional support needs will be impacted as well, won't they?
Yeah, some of our most vulnerable children are going to be impacted the most. And that's partly why we are moving to the legal challenge, because And a quality impact assessment has not been completed on these decisions at all. And that is part of the council's public sector responsibility. And so how can you make these decisions without fully knowing how it's going to impact particularly some of our most vulnerable pupils?
Yeah, so you're talking there about the equality impact assessment, which the Glasgow City Council told us that they have already published. A spokeswoman told us that a scoping equality impact assessment was published at the time of the council's budget in February this year, and that the working equality document is available on their website. So they're saying that they've already done that. Now you're taking legal action, but what do you hope to achieve by that?
So what she said is true, but that's not the full equality impact assessment. And the work that they're doing just now is after making the decisions, not before making the decisions. So I want to make that really clear that that's why we're moving forward. We've obviously consulted with lawyers around this, so we're not doing this on a whim. We know we have a strong case. What we want to achieve from this, I mean, in an ideal world, we'd want to see the decisions reversed. That probably won't happen. But the point of this legal challenge is that councils and public bodies cannot make decisions and impose poor decisions onto families that don't have the ability or the capacity to challenge that. They can't make decisions knowing that it will impact vulnerable groups without doing due process. And we want to hold the council accountable for that and make sure that they stick to their public responsibilities.
Now, the Scottish Government said it was offering local authorities £145.5 million, part of which was to protect teacher numbers. But in June, all 32 Scottish local authorities rejected this requirement to maintain teacher numbers. I suppose that just gives us a sense that everyone is facing difficult financial decisions right across Scotland at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. But it also shows you the kind of difference in the stance there. So some councils are cutting numbers and Scottish Government want to retain them. And I know that there's conversations happening about both of those narratives where there's a possibility that councils may lose further funding if they don't retain their teacher numbers. We know that we live in a challenging financial landscape at the moment, absolutely do. But when it gets to the point where education is impacted so drastically that we're not going to meet our children's needs in school, then that's when we have to stand up and do something about that. Education is what our group works in, so we can only speak on that kind of area of public policy. And so we can't just kind of sit back and let this happen to our children.
Leanne, thank you for joining us on Women's Hour this morning. Leanne Maguire there speaking to me from Glasgow. We have contacted the Scottish Government for a statement, but we have not yet received one. We reached out to Glasgow City Council and they've said that we have received legal correspondence that our lawyers are now reviewing. It would be inappropriate for us to comment further at this.
I'm Katrina Perry from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at Twitch. The biggest live streaming platform in the world is struggling to turn a profit. And now reports suggest that parent company Amazon could be losing patience in the project that it purchased for almost $1 billion a decade ago. The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Stage. Now to an interview that was on Woman's Hour a couple of years ago, but many of you may still remember it. In 2020, Jade Blue McCrossan Nethercott had the case against her alleged rapist dropped by the Crown Prosecution Service, or CPS, because the defence team said that she could suffer from sexsomnia. Now, sexsomnia is defined as a sleep disorder that involves a person engaging in sexual activity whilst asleep. They may appear awake and not be aware of their actions or have any memory of that sexual activity whatsoever. Well, over the last decade or so, there's been a marked increase in sexsomnia being used as a defence in rape trials, with defendants alleging that they suffer from sexsomnia and so are unaware of their actions. An investigation by the Observer newspaper suggested that of these cases where sexsomnia is used as a defence, 60% ended in a not guilty verdict. For my next guest, Jade Blue, her case was slightly unusual in that she, as the alleged victim, was suggested as having the condition. She spoke to Woman's Hour back in 2020 and told Emma Barnett what happened.
A few of us went back to a friend's house. A few people carried on drinking. I had a small glass of wine and decided that was kind of enough, kind of hit a bit of a kind of tired wall as such. So I opted to go to sleep. I've always kind of laughed and joked that I'm able to kind of sleep anywhere, really, and fell asleep in the living room while people were still drinking, smoking and listening to a bit of like music. I then woke up in the morning about 5 o'clock to having my trousers off, my underwear off, my bra unpinned at the back and my necklace broken. And I just felt like incredibly violated. I felt as if something had penetrated me, but I had no clue what. And I turned around and there was another person on the sofa.
2 years later, the CPS decided to charge the man in question with rape. He had pleaded not guilty. A trial was set. 2 weeks before the trial was due to start, you were asked to attend a meeting with the Crown Prosecution Service. The case didn't go ahead. It was dropped. What do you think of the reason for dropping it? Were you even aware of sexsomnia?
To me, it was complete nonsense. I didn't even know sexsomnia existed. So I ended up sourcing a private sleep specialist and did an at-home study.
And?
I have, like, some mild disposition, but I think, like, most of the public would. A bit of, like, snoring, mild sleep apnea, and any kind of remote history of sleepwalking or sleep talking as a child would be enough for them to potentially not rule it out. But it's always a mere possibility, never really an affirmative, which is even more frustrating, to be honest.
That was Jade Blue talking to Emma Barnett back in 2022. Well, after her case was dropped, Jade Blue submitted a victim's right to review. A chief Crown prosecutor reviewed the evidence and concluded that had the case gone to trial, the jury would have been more likely to reach a guilty verdict than not. The CPS apologised to Jade, but she still felt that that wasn't enough. So she sued the CPS for damages. And now, in an exclusive update to this story, we can tell you that Jade Blue has been awarded £35,000 in damages by the CPS. And I spoke to Jade Blue a little earlier and asked her how she was feeling about the compensation.
I mean, it's a big triumph, I would say. It's been a long time coming and a real battle to get to this kind of part in my justice journey, essentially. But I am feeling a sense of triumph, relief. There's a line in the sand now. I feel like some justice has kind of been served in some form, not how I'd originally anticipated. But it certainly feels that this is a positive outcome. And I'm really pleased that I've managed to hold the CPS accountable, essentially, for their failure to prosecute my rapist. So it does feel like a huge win, but not just for my case. I think it's a huge win for victims everywhere that we can hold the CPS accountable for their failures. So really holding on to that positive outcome there.
So you do feel like it's a positive. You said you feel like it's a triumph. You feel like, for you personally, you're able to possibly draw a line under what's happened to you because you got this settlement?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, the settlement is bittersweet, really. It's not really about the financial side for me. It's more so holding the CPS accountable and ensuring that they don't make these mistakes again. Unfortunately, I'm still yet to receive my lessons learned letter from the CPS, something that I have been asking since June 21 when the victim's right to review outcome came back. And I have been promised by the CPS that they, as part of this litigation process, that they were going to provide that. So I'm still waiting for that, and hopefully that will be soon. And I feel for me that would be the final line in the sand once I've really understood as to what things are being put in place, what policies and practices to avoid this happening again, because the damage is vast to victims that have to navigate that. It's just cruel and inhumane, really.
It's important to note that sexsomnia in legal cases can be used in quite different ways, can't it? I mean, most commonly, it's used by alleged perpetrators who claim that they didn't know that they were actually engaging in sexual activity because they were asleep, which is quite different to your particular case where sexsomnia was used against you to argue that some of your actions whilst asleep could have been perceived as given consent. I think it's just important to make that distinction for our audience who might not know what sexsomnia actually is.
Indeed, yes. I mean, it's definitely becoming an increased line of defence for perpetrators claiming they have it. It's almost glorified on some defence solicitors' websites, essentially, which is incredibly concerning. I do believe that it is a legitimate disorder, but I just think it's a really slippery slope, essentially, and I think the guidance needs to be better for both expert witnesses and the CPS in how they manage this kind of complex legalities around sleep disorders. They do have guidance, but I think it could probably be a bit better, and they do need to stick to their own guidance about robustly challenging these kind of lines of defence. But yeah, I do have concerns that this could be perhaps used against victims in the future, which is probably, for me, the main driving force that I was really keen to waive my anonymity and speak about this. But I do feel it has to be kind of looked into to protect victims being told they have it when they don't, perpetrators claiming they have it when they certainly don't, with very little evidence, but also for genuine sufferers of sexsomnia to not be wrongly convicted. I think that's really important, that for everyone across the board, that this sleep disorder is taken seriously within the courts. And I think that's a collaborative effort from both the CPS and the sleep specialists.
There was an investigation by The Observer in April this year, and it found that 80 cases over the past 30 years where defendants accused of rape, sexual assault or child sexual abuse claim to have been sleepwalking or suffering from sexsomnia at the time. And in the past decades, The Observer found at least 51 cases where people had used sexsomnia as a defence, 8 in the past year alone. So clearly there's an increase in people using this as a defence. How does that make you feel?
It makes me feel very uncomfortable. Yeah, it's just really concerning to see this increased use. It's something that just certainly needs to be addressed by the justice system as a whole. It's alarming.
And you've actually spoken to people with this disorder that legitimately have it?
Yes, yeah. I had a really insightful conversation with Rich in the documentary it came out in 2022, the documentary. And yeah, it was just really interesting to hear his perspective and how he would navigate that in a relationship. He was so considerate and really open with his partner, always checking in. And it's about having that open communication and ensuring that people are aware, if you do have that disorder, that you're aware that there's a risk associated with that.
And it's important to note that Rich wasn't involved in any legal case, but he was suffering with that disorder.
Yes, yeah, very much so. Not involved in any case, but that's it. The law needs to also protect people like him. You never know. It's just very concerning.
Talk to me about the process that you went through before you came to this settlement, because I think you started the process 3 years ago, back in 2021, by submitting your victim's right to review.
Yes, so my case was closed in October 2020, and it was about February 2021 where I put forward the victim's right to review, where the CPS essentially had an independent reviewer, kind of independent of the RASO unit, the Rape and Sexual Offences unit that was based in London, that made the decision to close my case. This independent review came back and they essentially acknowledged that they made a mistake and that they do believe that he would have been found guilty if they'd taken it to trial, which they obviously couldn't do now, which is, yeah, very bittersweet. But yeah, finding out that it was because of sexsomnia and this notion of sexsomnia, from the instant I was this is wrong, this is an error in decision-making here. I felt like this was a completely unjust decision, very hasty and not very well thought out. I was absolutely shell-shocked. From that point, that was a real downward spiral for me. I'd lost all faith in the system. I'd already had challenges with the police and just generally going through the hefty process of trying to get a case to court for rape. But this was a shell shock moment for me. It just completely destroyed me and definitely took me to the darkest points. I'd never considered any kind of suicidal ideation from the incident of the rape, but the actual interactions with the justice system, more so specifically the CPS, had very much sent me to those points, which was a really hard thing to come to terms with.
Despite all that difficulty and everything that you've been through, Jade, you're still voicing your story, you're still fighting the system. Why are you doing that? What is it that inspires you to keep going?
I think every other victim inspired me to keep going. This case against the CPS has never just been about my experience directly. I think for me, it was important to kind of shine a light that we can raise our voices, we can make ourselves heard, and we have every right to hold these agencies to account when they fail us. And I just hope that other people know that their voices are powerful, and I'm really hopeful that this kind of case and this outcome just shows that if something feels untoward or unjust, speak up, speak out about it. I think that's what's really important, because I think that's how we're going to get systemic change, is by the more voices collectively coming together and calling this out, essentially.
And how aware do you think people are of their right to be able to fight institutions like the CPS and use the right of review?
I don't think it's commonly known. I think there's definitely work to be done in emphasising avenues of challenging these systems. You very much have to be your own fierce advocate navigating the justice system. I spent so much time educating myself, reading up, reaching out to charities, seeking support and advice. And it shouldn't be that difficult. There should be like a straightforward process, and allowing like victims to empower themselves to be able to navigate that and speak up if needed. It's something that definitely needs to be addressed. I mean, there has been a push on the Victims Code recently from the Ministry of Justice, but again, it can't just be a one-off push. It has to be a continuous conversation. So I think that's really important.
There was a recommendation by the former Victims Commissioner, Dame Vera Baird, in her 2022 report on the Victims Bill, where she said that victims of crimes should be given independent legal advice. Do you agree with that?
Oh, very much so. I think that would have been a huge game changer for my process as well. I think it's really important to be able to have that kind of independent legal advice. Before the CPS make any hasty decisions, all this could be avoided, and the trauma and the damage kind of inflicted could be avoided if there was somebody kind of advocating in your corner. Because at the end of the day, victims that are going through the justice process, they don't have any legal advice. It's you kind of tend to meet your CPS prosecutor on the day and kind of hope for the best, that they know your case in and out and they've got your best interest. But I'd say from what I've read and the victims I've spoken to, that is far from reality, unfortunately.
Jade Blue, it's been 7 years since the incident itself to today, and it sounds like you've been through so much. What impact has all of this had on you?
Gosh, yes. It is nuts thinking how long it's been. It's been such a long process. I was 24 when the incident happened. I'm 32 now and still kind of in some form or the other trying to seek justice. The impact has been vast, really, really challenging. From report to court, or nearly to court anyway, in my instance, that had its own issues. But the CPS side of things, when they close a case, that was the most impactful. As I said before, from suicidal ideation to completely losing myself, I was off work for six months. I took a demotion, very much took a step back in my career. There's things I'd wanted to achieve by now. I was really keen to perhaps start a family by now, and so kind of my life has been essentially put on pause. And then onto the physical side of things as well, during the CPS process, it was really challenging. I must have put on about like 20 kilos, really unhealthy coping mechanisms, eating ridiculous amounts of food, binging, alcohol consumption, relying on medication. It's a lot. It takes you to the darkest points, and only now do I feel like I've actually reclaimed some of myself back. Perhaps a more fiercely, I don't know, independent woman, I guess. Perhaps I think before I may have been like a naive girl trying to had a rose-tinted vision of the world, thinking that the justice system had our best interests. But now I feel very much those rose-tinted glasses were off, and the stark reality of the state of our justice system has really, I think, changed my perception. I think what I do struggle with a lot is decision-making people in my life, which have like decision-making authority over any kind of anything from work to general life. Like, I feel like I have to second guess everything, and it's a really hard burden to carry constantly. It's tiring. Like, you have to educate yourself on everything, really kind of just ensure that everything is right and the I's are dotted, T's are crossed and all that jazz. So it does take a lot from you. It's a tiring state to be in constantly.
Of course it is. We've been speaking a lot about the CPS, and they have sent in this statement. A Crown Prosecution Service spokesman said a settlement has been reached with Miss McCrossan Nethercott, to whom we have apologised unreservedly, and we continue to wish her the very best going forward. We are committed to improving every aspect of how life-changing crimes like rape are dealt with and are working closely with police from an early stage to ensure we focus on the behaviour and actions of the suspect, not the victim. Now, Jade Blue, it sounds like you are moving into a more positive space in your life after everything that's happened. So what's next? Surely you're owed a break, aren't you? Some rest.
Perhaps so. It might take a couple of days. But yeah, I think I'm just going to continue advocating and campaigning as much as I can. I feel like there's a lot of work to be done within the justice system, and these agencies do need to listen to victims' voices. I think that's the only way that we're ever going to get any kind of systemic change and real reform. I'm going to continue calling for strengthening the victims' right to review process, because essentially it wasn't fit for purpose in my case. And if there's mechanisms before that and perhaps escalation processes, perhaps it would have changed the outcome of my case and my perpetrator would have had his day in court. So that's something I feel quite strongly about. But also with the sex homonia defence as well, I feel like a lot of guidance needs to be improved in regards to that. So I do intend to continue using my voice in whatever form that may take. I'm quite excited for the future for the first time in a long time. I feel like this is very much kind of drawing a line in the sand. It's quite weird because I often disassociate the fact that this is my own experience. I think it might be a coping mechanism to be able to navigate life generally. So yeah, I definitely will take some downtime and get creative with some ideas. I've got some interesting ideas to run with over the coming months about amplifying victims' voices. So yeah, I'm very excited for the next steps.
That was Jade Blue McCrossan Nethercott speaking to me earlier. And of course, if you've been affected by anything that you've heard in that interview, there are links to support and resources on our website. I just want to turn to a few of the messages that we've had coming in from you, our listeners, because I asked you at the beginning of the show about how you celebrated in your moments of success. Diane, good morning, Diane. She's been listening and she's messaged in to say, I'm 62 years old. I left my job after 32 years. On my last day of work, I did a backflip along the corridor. I thought no one was there, but turned around to loud applause from the cleaner. That is absolutely fantastic. I'd love to be able to backflip. Well done, Diane. Another message. Every time we get to the till at the supermarket, my husband throws his arms in the air and cheers when he swipes our club card through the machine and we get a discount. It always makes the person on the till laugh. And just a message here coming in about the chat that we had with one of your favourite Olympians, Emily Campbell. They've said, I love the discussion about weightlifting and strong women's abilities. Let's hear it for fostering muscle strength, not dress size, as one of our health promotion goals. Do keep your messages coming in. But now let's talk about Beryl Cook. The artist found fame in the 1970s with her colourful, humorous depictions of the everyday people that she encountered having fun. She died in 2008, but her work continues to be celebrated. And I'm joined now by the actor Cara Wilson, whose play about Beryl is on at the moment at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. And her daughter, the comedian Nina Conti, also has a film playing at the Fringe, and it marks her debut as a director. I want to talk to you both about living together during the Fringe Festival. I do wonder how many people would do this voluntarily. I'm not sure I'd be able to handle it, but we'll get to that. But first, Cara, I'll talk to you about Beryl Cook. Tell us about her. I know that she didn't start painting properly until her 30s. Is that right?
35 she was, yes. Wow. And was more or less by accident. She was trying to get her son, John, aged 10, interested in painting or anything. And so she challenged him to a competition to copy a little painting she'd found. And then suddenly they all looked and found, oh my goodness, mark and paint. But she didn't paint again for a few years after that. And it was, but once she did start, she could not stop. And she painted like wild. And I have to say that as you're talking about celebrations, this is my celebration of being 80. What do you do when you're 80? Take the show to the fringe. Take a show.
Why not?
Just go wild. Why not? I've always done shows about painters, and Beryl Cook fascinated me for a long time. But she has living relatives, and I thought, oh, maybe they won't like it, because I've only done dead artists before. So I got in touch. I managed to get in touch with her son, John, and he loved the idea, and we worked together. So more or less, the play is made up of things she actually said. She was a very shy, private woman that nobody knew about.
She was very reserved, wasn't she? Although she is widely known in the art world, and she was, of course, awarded that OBE, she was shy. Is that right?
She was shy. She certainly wouldn't go in front of public. She wouldn't go to her private views. I tried to meet her years and years ago by going to a book signing of a book she had illustrated. But of course she wasn't there. She never went out. She was so shy. And so nobody really knew what she looked like.
So what would she make of this then? The fact that you've made this entire play about her and her life?
Well, I think she would love it. I hope she would love it. Her son said if I had been any more like her, he couldn't have bared to watch it. And he also said he was very grateful to me for allowing her to say in public things that she really believed but was too shy to say.
So tell us about the production then. You play Beryl Cook, sat in her studio, I believe. What is it that the audience sees?
They see me recreate for a camera. She wouldn't do an interview for an audience, so I can't speak to the audience. She's speaking to a camera that the BBC have set up to record her at work. And so she copies for George of the BBC, whom she keeps talking to. She copies a bit of Ladies' Night, which is a wonderful painting of a stripper in a Soho pub. So I paint for an hour, and at the end of the hour, the audience can buy that little study.
Brilliant. And what reaction have you been getting?
Oh, well, they love it. They do laugh when I say, and if you want to buy the painting. But so far, they're going. They're really going. I've sold them all, nearly. And they're all exactly the same. The family said, yes, you can sell this study as long as you don't sign it Beryl. Sign it with your own name and write on the back what it is. So there are many people going away with keepsakes.
Now, I did mention, didn't I, about keeping it in the family. Let's bring in a fellow Fringe performer, your daughter, Nina Conti. Good morning, Nina.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm great. It's great to have you both on at the same time in the same house, which we'll come to. You've been performing at the Fringe this year as well, Nina. It's been incredible, I'm sure. Tell us who's there with you, because you've got other family members as well. It's not just your mum.
I'm running away. I'm going to sit right next to the thing. I think I lost you. Hello?
Hello. Can you still hear me okay, Nina? I was asking about who else from the rest of your family is with you, because I believe it's not just your mum.
In the house, we've got my cat, we've got my my partner, Shanoa, who also has a show on, my two sons, and my son's girlfriend and his best friend are coming today, so it's a really busy house.
It's a family affair then, isn't it? What's it been like having everyone there together, living under the same roof, in the same space? Be honest.
I'm a prima donna before I get ready for my show, so everyone has to avoid me at that point. I get in a real panic with my hair tongs and my go forget my monkey and run back in because I haven't got my keys. So I'm quite bad before I leave. But we're kind of passing ships in the night. I mean, Mum, you go quite quietly off to your show, very calmly on a bicycle. I've got to say, I think it's amazing what my mum's doing, aged 80, bringing this show to the Fringe and going every day on a bicycle with an easel, like a pallet full of paints and cycling through the meadows. It's pretty cool.
Cara, that's extraordinary.
Yes, I leave before everybody gets up. So it's very quiet for me. My preparation hour is very nice. No, I had to be very careful that I kept my palette horizontal on my bike. But it's working well. I haven't fallen off yet.
And how would you say everyone interacts with each other?
I think we're good because we've been doing this for years. This is my first time for a long time to do a show. But for 20 years, I've been coming to the Fringe with Nina. And my job has been something different. It's been taking over when she gets to be prima donna at 4 o'clock and taking the boys out and giving them dinners and things like that. So we've been here for 20 years. It's not unusual.
Not unusual, but I suppose the roles have changed slightly, Nina. How does it feel now that Grandma is also a Fringe performer?
I'm so happy for her to be. And she's doing great and selling out. And it's like, yeah, it's fantastic. And being like, I mean, just being a great support all these years to me and the boys, it's fantastic that Granny gets a go. That's her words, not mine. She says Granny gets a go.
I know.
Yeah, it's really good.
It's a really busy one, this, because not only has Nina got a show, so we've got extra excitement this week because she's got her film coming out in the film festival. So it's all happening at once.
Yeah, and how do you feel, Nina, about making your debut as a director?
It's wonderful. It's difficult to break into the film industry, and so I sort of come through comedy to do that, and it was 6 years in the making, and I'm really excited that it gets to play at the Edinburgh Film Festival, which is kind of the home of my comedy all these years anyway. So that's this weekend, 4 screenings, and I'm really excited to share it.
I bet you are. Are you expecting a positive audience reaction? Is there any way to judge? I mean, do you know how the audience are going to react to your material?
It made me cry.
I think it made my mum cry, but it's been funny. It's the main story is this woman who lives in a sort of mascot of a monkey. She prefers to be a monkey than herself. And I relate to that because for years I've been expressing myself through a monkey puppet. And so if you can be hidden and androgynous and a complete, complete mystery, you get a much more liberated life, you know? And so it's kind of what happens in Love Story when she falls in love with a derailed radio host played by Shanoa Allen, who also wrote it. And I think people find it quite sort of dysfunctional and darkly funny. Hopefully it brings joy. I mean, that was my big thing. I want to bring joy because there's too much misery about these days. somewhere to go and just see like a fun road trip movie.
But Cara, you said it's made you cry.
Yes,
tears of joy?
Joy, absolute joy. I mean, who would think a film about a woman in a monkey suit would be so wonderfully enlivening and entertaining? And my husband and I, Tom and I, sat there absolutely spellbound. There isn't a dull second in the film. And so at the end, it was just the relief. I wept. I wept in Nina's arms.
That is a beautiful reaction.
That was so beautiful. It's very sweet.
I wept the first time I saw her do ventriloquism when she was about late 20s. That was the same reaction. There was nothing to do but cry from joy. Oh, God, this is wonderful. So
you could be crying for another reason when you find out your kid's a ventriloquist. Oh, Lord, you've picked a hard road here.
No. It sounds like she is very proud. Ladies, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on Woman's Hour this morning. That's Cara Wilson and Nina Conti. Both Cara and Nina performing at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival until the 25th of August. And they might even still be living together by the end of it. Hey. Who knows? You can join me again tomorrow from 10 o'clock. Kyla Harris, co-creator and star of a new BBC comedy series, We Might Regret This, will be joining me. And don't forget, next week is Listeners Week. On this programme, your chance to get us to cover absolutely anything. You wanted to hear from your favourite Olympian, Emily Campbell. We brought her on, so keep your ideas coming in. I'll be back tomorrow. And that's all for today's Woman's Hour. Join us again next time.
In December 1969, Muriel Mackay vanished from her London home.
You have your wife. It will cost you £1 million to get her back.
Two men, targeting Rupert Murdoch's wife, Anna, had abducted Muriel by mistake. It was the first high-profile kidnapping in British history, and the tabloid press were hooked.
You know, was she alive? Was she dead?
The police were baffled.
It's the most hideous crime, kidnapping. It's worse than just a straight murder.
And Muriel's family was thrown into a nightmare that continues to this day.
I just want to find my mother's body.
I'm Jane McSorley, and this is Intrigue, Worse Than Murder. Listen on BBC Sounds.